how the ark was to be transported. And it never says put it on a cart because it's easier. It never says that. It says don't touch the ark. But as they're traveling along, it says in our hidden scriptures that the oxen stumbled and the ark began to fall. And Uzzah, being a servant and knowing that this is the ark of God, he puts his hand out to stop it from falling off the cart and going into the dirt. And when he does, he is struck dead immediately. Immediately. Because God said, you don't touch the ark. You want to move the ark? I gave you four rings. I gave you these staves. I told you how to do it. It's a fine example of God being the God of justice. I gave you the rule. You broke it. Down you go. It's not the example we look for from God, is it? Our hope is when we make a mistake and touch the ark for reasons we think are good, that our God will be the God of mercy. And mercifully, that's what our God is most of the time. But we have this example of the God of justice. Now, David, seeing all this thing, says, whoa, hold the phone here. So he stops, and for 3 months he doesn't bring the ark into Jerusalem. Then he gets word that there have been blessings and everything's fine. And if you read the scripture carefully, now there's no cart anymore. And they take 6 steps and stop. You imagine David gone. Okay, we good? Nobody got knocked down dead? No smitings here? He stops, and that's where he makes the sacrifice of the animals. And that's right there when he begins to dance like a crazy man. He's now coming in to Jerusalem. He's bringing the Ark of the Covenant. He's going to establish himself as the new king. And he's dancing wildly, turning around, and he is joyful. He is filled with God's Spirit, and he is dressed perhaps immodestly. He's wearing what they call the linen ephod, which is a dress. Perhaps they said it was immodest because that's all he was wearing. Sometimes people like to say he was dancing naked before the Lord. That's not in the Bible. But he was dancing not in the robes of the royal king. He was not dancing with a crown. He was not walking with his head held high in a regal manner. He was joyful and jubilant and dancing before God. Now imagine yourself there, how other people would react, because I'll bet maybe half or so would say, man, look at David. He is filled with that spirit this morning. He's really getting to me. He's loving God. He is the man after God's own heart. And the other half of the people are going, you know, that ain't right. No, you can't do that. You're the king. You're supposed to behave. Have some sense of decorum. Isn't that how it would be? Wouldn't it have been that way this morning if that's how I came marching in? Right? Wouldn't it have been? Now, some people thought it was wrong for David to do that. David, inspired by God's Spirit, dancing in joy and jubilation, comes in, and there's his wife, Michal, watching from the window. And it says, from that moment, she detested him in her heart. And I think it's a fine example. And I'm not saying that, David, you're a lousy dancer. I think that there was some effect on her that she didn't like. And isn't that often when we say, you are wrong? Because you are wrong for me. Michal, his wife, who was also the daughter of the previous king Saul, who would never have danced like that before the Lord. Perhaps the wife that says, you bring shame to me, David, acting like a crazy drunken guy. Look at you. You're not supposed to dress like that in front of the people. Where are the robes? For her own purposes, she says, you are wrong. David says, I'm not wrong. I am not wrong. She doesn't explain to him why. She just, for her own purposes, you are wrong. And apparently, that was the beginning of the end of that relationship, because it says she never had children from that day to the day of her death. Was David wrong? I don't think that's up to me. But I also don't think it's up to Michal. Now take that thought and move it forward to the gruesome story of John the Baptist's murder. And here we have Herod and Herodias, the man and his wife. Now this is Herod, the son of Herod, who was the great King Herod who killed all the babies to try to kill Jesus when he came into the world. This is his son. But there wasn't just one king now. He had divided his kingdom between his sons. And there was Herod, and there was another brother, and there was a brother, Philip. And Herod and his wife go over to visit the brother, and he goes over to visit his brother, Philip, and comes back with Philip's wife. John the Baptist, who's in the neighborhood, begins to say, "You know, Herod, you're wrong." Herodias, who's the new wife, says, "I'm not wrong." "Herod, shut him up. Shut him up, Herod. I'm not wrong. I don't want him saying those terrible things about me." So Herod, being a spineless person that he will prove to be later, locks John the Baptist up, a man who he enjoyed listening to and knew he could learn from. Locks him up because his new wife says so. So there's John in the pit, and there's Herod and his wife Herodias. And it comes around to the day of Herod's birthday, and he throws himself a party. I don't think you can be a very popular guy if you got to throw yourself the birthday party. But that's what he was doing. And it sounds like it was stag night. And the young daughter of his new wife, whose name was Salome, is the one who dances for her. Now, if you get your Bible history from movies or from the opera, you might think that this was a voluptuous person doing the Dance of the Seven Veils. It wasn't. The language used to describe Salome is that she's a young girl, like 12 or 13 years old. But Herod wants her to dance for his buddies, for whatever reason. So he says to her, "If you'll do that, if you'll dance for her, I'll give you anything, even up to half of my kingdom, if you'll dance for my friends." And he makes a promise that he'll do that in front of all of his buddies. So she doesn't know what she wants. So she runs and asks Mommy. Mommy, that wants to shut John the Baptist up. And she says, "Oh, you can have anything? Tell him you want the head of John the Baptist on a platter." Back she goes, "I know what I want, uncle, stepfather. What I want is the head of John the Baptist on the silver platter." And now, here's a guy that can't tell his wife he's wrong and says he doesn't want to break his word in front of his friends, so the best alternative is to cut the head off of John the Baptist. So they do, immediately, and bring the head to him. And it says they brought it to the girl and she immediately gave it to her mother. I imagine there was a bit of ooh. But Herodias didn't want to be told she was wrong. But John the Baptist said, "You are wrong," said to her and all the people in those towns and villages and to anybody who would listen, "It's wrong. You don't go and take your brother's wife." How do we know who to listen to? When people tell us we're wrong, is it John the Baptist telling us, or is it the guy down the street? I mean, very often when people want to tell us we're wrong, it really is just so you'll agree with them, right? It's not very often that we just immediately change our mind. How do we decide in a world where we spend a lot of time telling people you're wrong? That's what we do. If we say it enough times, we give ourselves a reason to go to war. You say, "You're wrong. You don't think like me, look like me, march like me, sing the songs that I sing. You're not like me. You don't love the kind of people I love. You're wrong." We couldn't have a war if we dropped that attitude. I don't think we could have poverty if we had that attitude. If we would shed this belief that I have what I have because of what I deserve, and you don't have anything because you don't deserve it, so therefore I don't want to share with you. What we do when we say you're wrong is we put ourselves here, and the other person is here, and we know that's how it feels. We know that you think you're better than me, that you think that you appointed yourself God. You're wrong. I got to teach you that. Here's where we're supposed to be. Right here. And it's God that's up there. So if we need to tell somebody we're wrong, it occurs to me we have a far better chance of meeting them right there. In mercy, not in judgment. To say, you know, it might be better if. Or to start the conversation that says something like, you know, I love you. I come to you aware of all the dignity that you deserve. And I'd like to talk to you about something. Isn't that the way Jesus came into the world? Just like one of us? Met us where we are in love? Isn't that it? He didn't do a lot of telling stories that started with, you're wrong. And when he did, he told a story that you could recognize yourself in. You know, there were these three guys. Now, I don't presume for a moment to tell you that you're wrong. I wouldn't know how to do that. I have enough struggle with that myself. But the way in which I've been inspired by this in these readings this week is this way. When people tell me I'm wrong, I know my response is probably going to be, no, I'm not. I need to be willing to listen to that. But I also need to do that within the context of knowing all they want me to do is think like them. But what about if John the Baptist says it to you? John the Baptist, who's the guy that Jesus called the greatest man who ever lived. If John the Baptist tells you you're wrong, I'm betting you stay wrong. So let's not listen to the voice of the people, but listen for that prophetic voice of God that speaks to us and tells us, that's not right. You're wrong. Listen for the voice of God through the prophets that always encourage us along with the thing that gets in our conscience that says, you know, I'm wrong about this. I need to rethink this. I need to pray about it. Let's listen for the message from God, which will always include words of love and mercy.